Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. I hope people can hear me. The topic today is a very, very broad topic that really would require a lifetime, because indeed this is an issue that we face in our life throughout. I'd like to begin with one thought. There is a Medrash that says that when the Jewish people were at the Red Sea, in the moment of panic, they divided themselves into four different groups. One group said, "Let us jump into the ocean." And another group said, "Let us return to Egypt and be slaves." And a third group said, "Let us wage war." And a fourth group said, "Let us cry out to the Umot HaOlam, perhaps they will come and rescue us." And there are many, many, and of course all of those responses were wrong. HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, just jump into the ocean and have emunah. But given the homiletical license, I'd like to offer an interpretation where this medrash actually represents the dilemma that we face today. Because in an allegorical sense, the torrential waters of the Red Sea represents our confrontation with a secular and decadent culture, much of which is antagonistic to the Torah. We find in Shir HaShirim, Mayim Rabim Lo Yuchlu L'Chabos Esa'ava, great waters cannot extinguish the fire of love of Hashem. The great waters is a remez for the Umos HaOlam and all of that culture. So, when the Jewish people are facing the sea, they are facing what we face, the challenges of everyday life, the challenges of a secular culture. And there are four ways we can respond, and each of the four are incorrect in one way. One way is jump into the sea, which could be paraphrased as eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. Meaning, embrace that secular culture, indulge, take it in, which of course is the equivalent of committing suicide, drowning. The other response is, let us become slaves. That would represent what I think, unfortunately, is a prevailing response, and that is the concept of the schizophrenic Jew, in which at home I try to live a Jewish life, a Torah life, on Shabbos, on Yom Tov, in the Shul, in the Beis HaMedrash, but I'm man and woman of the world from 9 to 5, and then when I'm home, I become, you know, an Eved Hashem. That's kind of the schizophrenic existence of the slave, who on one hand serves the master during working hours, and then retreats into his little zone of privacy. Dichotomy, schizophrenia. The third response, let us wage war, we might call ghettoization, in which everything out there is treif. I reject that world. I will create my artificial world within ghettos, often called a ghetto of the mind, in which you're living in America, but you blot everything out. And the fourth, which is not directly relevant to this, is the notion of defining your Judaism by simply appealing to the nations of the world, meaning to say, often we find that Jews who are not so religious, their Jewish identity stems from their victimization, from anti-Semitism. And they say, we're Jews because there was a Holocaust. We're Jews because there are enemies, and because there are enemies in the world that want to destroy us. And we affirm our Judaism by calling on the nations to protect us from our enemies. It's been well said that for many Jews, if anti-Semitism were to miraculously disappear overnight, these organizations would go out of business because they're so busy defining Judaism by those who hate Jews that they never give Yiddishkeit a positive meaning. So basically, we have the concept of secularism, wholesale embrace, the concept of schizophrenia and dichotomy, the concept of ghettoization, and the concept of victimization. And all of these are not the correct responses, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said all of these are incorrect. And in point of fact, you know, all of us like in life, you know, you go to a Rav, you ask a question, is it kosher or treif? Is it yes or no? And all of us want to know, is it yes or no? Unfortunately, when it comes to matters of hashkafa, we often do not have the same definite yes or no answer that we have in halacha. But we get answers such as, it depends, you got to do both, you got to incorporate, you got to know what to take in. And this is indeed a great dilemma that all of us face. When Yaakov Avinu meets Esav, Yaakov Avinu says, Hatzileni na, pray, he prays to Hashem, please save me, miyad ochi, miyad Esav, from my brother, from Esav. What is the redundancy? The Beis Halevi says very simple. Yaakov is afraid of two things. Yaakov is afraid of the Esav who wants to physically destroy him. But Yaakov is afraid, what if Chas v'Shalom Esav comes to me as a brother and a friend? Then I'm even in bigger trouble. Because the Esav that comes to me as an enemy will destroy my body. But the Esav that comes to me as a friend can destroy my neshama. Now, as I hope my earlier remarks made clear, I do believe that as Torah Jews, we should see the unconditional worth of other human beings, Jews and Goyim. We should indeed see that all human beings are made with Tzelem Elokim. It's not only Jews and certainly not only religious Jews. And that racist and disparaging and insulting remarks about other people should have no place in a Jewish home, not only because of Hilchos Lashon Hara, which is also a reason, although there's a question whether Lashon Hara applies on non-Jews, but simply because it's a denigration of what the Torah describes as a Tzelem Elokim. When we degrade human beings, we are degrading HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kavyachol, because human beings are made B'Tzelem Elokim. So, on one level, we have to look at people and see the good in them and train ourselves to see the good. You know, there's an old Chassidish Vort. The reason why we have two eyes is one eye should be focused on others and see the good. The other eye should be focused inward, not to see only the bad, but to see what within ourselves we're capable of correcting. It's always so easy to blame Mashiach not coming on the other person. Something somebody else is, that is why we're in such a predicament, because that takes the heat off ourselves. At the same time, we have to recognize that we do live in a world of moral relativism, of ethical subjectivity, of I'm okay, you're okay, which can really destroy a sense of passion and commitment and fervor to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah. And the question is, how do you create an environment in which you have a sense of what to accept and what to reject? Now, I want to say that for most, although, I mean, unfortunately, we do have the phenomenon of kids at risk, as they're now called, and even here in Baltimore, it's a very, very serious problem. But we would still say that for most kids, the issue is not they're going to be Mechallelei Shabbos. I mean, Baruch Hashem, I think we could say that by and large, with many exceptions, but by and large, if a child is raised in a Shomer Shabbos home, they will be Shomer Shabbos. So you might say, obviously, the outside culture isn't affecting our children because they'll grow up to be frum. But that is a very, very sad mistake. Because Rav Shimshon Farl Hirsch once remarked about 19th century Orthodox Jews that we are today the opposite of the Muranos of Spain. The Muranos of Spain may have been Goyim on the outside, but Jews in their hearts. We, Chas V'Shalom, can sometimes be Jews on the outside, but what's in the inside? We may go through the external motions of keeping mitzvahs. We daven three times a day, we learn, we put on tefillin, but what excites... Well, again, I'm sorry, I apologize. I mean, the women, they're not put on tefillin, but whatever mitzvahs people do, men, women, children, we do the mitzvahs. But what is it that excites us? What is it that gives us passion? What is it that gives us vibrancy? Are we and our children, chas v'shalom, like the opposite of the Muranos, the reverse Murano, where we go through the external motions of Yiddishkeit, but it no longer speaks to us, it no longer sings to us, it no longer revives us? And if that is a problem, and again, every person has to make their own decision, part of that is that when you live in a culture of materialism and the human gets used to comforts and luxuries and physicalities and excitements, just as a person who has a diet of junk food will not be attuned to the finer, subtle tastes of fancy cuisine, then kal v'chomer, when we are attuned to physicality, materialism, and secularism, our hearts are no longer responsive to the pleasures of Ruchnius. And the reason that is so is because human beings are always creatures of instant gratification. I remember when I was in eighth grade reading about the War of 1812. You know, Andrew Jackson, who was a president of the United States, before he was president, he actually won a medal for the Battle of New Orleans, which was a battle in the War of 1812. But the battle was actually fought 3 weeks after the peace treaty was signed in Belgium. Because in those days, communication was so slow that a peace treaty had been signed, but they kept on fighting. So he actually won a battle for a war which had already been finished. It used to take a long time, right? If you mail a letter from New York to, well, actually, it may still take that amount of time, New York to Baltimore, it may have taken 2 weeks. I remember when I first got a fax machine And I had to send a fax to China, to Hong Kong. And it took around 35 seconds. I was drumming my fingers. What is taking so long? So the point of the matter is, we have become accustomed to instant gratification in everything. If our phones don't work, we throw it away and get another one, etc. God forbid if our marriages don't work, we throw it away and try to get another one. And again, Rachmana Litzlan, in some segments of society, if our babies don't work, Chas v'shalom, people even kill the babies or abort or whatever it is. All of this is the philosophy of instant gratification. But instant gratification translates into ruchnius as well. We all want to be tzaddikim, but we want to be tzaddikim overnight. It is said in the name of the Rishon Salanter, every person wants to know Shas. Baruch Hashem, that's a good goal. Every person wants to know Shas in one night. That's a much, much harder goal. Only the Vilna Gaon could do that. Okay. But everybody wants to know Shas in one night and get 8 hours of sleep that same night. He says, even the Vilna Gaon couldn't do that one. And the concept is that ruchnius and spiritual growth is a slow process. It involves work. It involves commitment. It's brick by brick, inch by inch. But then at the end, you look back and you see, and all of us, anyone that's a parent, knows that the same process of raising a child. You know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made babies very cute. In fact, the Sfarim even say this. Babies are extraordinarily cute because otherwise there's no person in the world that would put up with all of this type of work. Right? But so Hashem made it easier by giving us cute, adorable children so that we become their slaves for so many years. But what's the idea? You put in the effort. And the more the effort, the greater is the pleasure and the fulfillment. Lefum tsaragu, that's true in learning, it's true in child raising, it's true in marriage. The more we work, the more pleasure we get at the end. However, instant gratification has an opposite type of psychology. If I don't get what I want now, I just throw it away. And the problem is this. Once you get exposed to materialism and secularism and decadence, you get addicted to the instant gratification. And once you're addicted to the instant gratification, ruchnius can't compete anymore. How can learning a Daf Gemara compete with an exciting video game? Frankly, it's not as exciting. It's not as immediate feedback. You see? So when we say our children are not affected because we have frum homes, we're not affected because we're frum, at most, that just means that Baruch Hashem will go through the externalities of living a Jewish life. But how much of the neshama is damaged, is hurt, right? And I have to say that this is very, very frightening. I mean, I do work with teenagers and see teenagers and the like, and, you know, wonderful, wonderful kids. I'm not talking about me at all. Even the children at risk are wonderful kids. But even the kids who are fine and doing well, sometimes you get a sense of almost a gaping emptiness inside, in which they're Jews because they're Jews, but there's no, you know, we don't see it yet. We don't see the Avas Hashem, the Yiras Hashem. And all of this is something that is something that we face all the time. Those of us who are in the working world, or those of us who are stay-at-home parents, either way, sometimes we're so drained and even physically exhausted that it's hard for us to get up that type of enthusiasm. So these are the great, great dangers that we face. We live in a society of instant gratification. We live in a society of moral relativism. We live in a society where if we don't get what we want right away, we simply get frustrated and throw it away. And Torah is predicated on so many opposite assumptions. First, let me mention, because the title here is Halachic and Hashkafic, let me just mention Halacha a little bit, although I don't want to give a shiur primarily in Halacha. There are, of course, obviously, Halachic issues that we face on the outside all the time, particularly if one is working outside the home, and indeed particularly if one is a woman. There are unique Halachas to women. The Gemara tells us in Bava Basra that a miyut of people, a minority of people, commit the sins of Gilui Arayos, forbidden sexual prohibitions. Most people commit the sin of theft, Gezel, and all people commit the sin of Lashon Hara. If you consider the contemporary workplace, you very much see that these three halachic issues do exist everywhere. Arayos, again, I don't want to be myrich on this. I'll just be very, very subtle. But all of us know, with the proliferation of sexual harassment and the like, I think all of us see, in retrospect, the tremendous wisdom of the Torah in erecting barriers. In fact, I have to say, I was laughing at this. You know, companies now have to prepare sexual harassment manuals in order to, and I'm reading, and it looks like it's a translation of Shulchan Aruch Yerideya. They say, a man should never be alone with a woman without the door being opened. Women are told they should dress in a more modest, less revealing fashion. So, you know, 20 years ago, people made fun of these halachas, if you weren't from here. Oh, you guys primitive, you're living in the Middle Ages. And now, the manuals that are prepared by big corporations incorporate all of these guidelines. So suffice it to say that one needs to be very, very attuned to the midos of tznius and proper boundaries within the workplace. It is a nisayon that unfortunately has broken up more than one home with very, very tragic consequences. Issues of gezel? Well, what is gezel? Most of us didn't get up this morning and rob a bank, to be sure. You know, I don't steal. But, you know, gezel has many, many forms. There is, for example, using supplies at work without permission for personal use, making phone calls, taking excessive coffee breaks, geneva stas, which is lying or misrepresentation in business transactions. For example, let's assume that you're filing for medical insurance, a claim, and something is not quite covered, so you change it in order to obtain the money. Again, these are things that people often do, and people sometimes say, well, you know, it's only an insurance company. They have plenty of money, which is true. But indeed, that is a form of gezel, of theft, of misrepresentation. You know, sometimes people say, well, it's only goyim. You know, I can cheat goyim. Well, besides the fact that if that is ever discovered, the awesome, awesome, terrifying chilul Hashem that is created. And remember what Chilul Hashem is. Chilul Hashem is a sin that Yom Kippur does not erase, and Tshuva does not erase, and suffering does not erase. There is no atonement for Chilul Hashem until death. So be very wary about that. But even if you knew, you're not going to be caught. Of course, people will say, you know, even if you knew, you weren't going to be caught. There's a beautiful passage from the Smag, Sefer Mitzvah Skuddle. He was one of the Rishonim that lived in the 1300s. Where he says that when Jews cheat and lie in their business, the nations look at them and they say to Hashem, what type of God is it that picks such liars and cheaters as his people? This is what the Smag writes. And I should also mention, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said a very, very beautiful thought. He said that he wasn't even interested in going over the halachos of Goy versus Jew, because he said, once you develop in yourself the capacity to lie and cheat, you're not going to be able to limit it to that situation. It's going to spread and permeate every aspect of your life. So even if the halacha might say a given thing is permitted, but beware of the fact that when you start behaving in that certain way, it's going to carry over. And that's very true, because midos are not divisible. You can't be a person that says, I only lose my temper to Reuven and I'm so sweet to everybody else. It's not true. You have the midah of anger. It's going to come across everywhere. Dishonest, cheat, it'll come across otherwhere, right? The Medrash Taka says, he who kills the guy will wind up killing the Jew. He who cheats the guy will wind up cheating the Jew. So the whole idea of start being mafalpel and all sorts of heterim for this and that is really besides the point, because we're destroying our midos in the process. So, and of course, what can I say about the third one, which everybody is over on, Lashon Hara? Well, as all of you know, of course, Baruch Hashem, I have to say, Lashon Hara is a, it's not a mitzvah, the Aveira of not speaking Lashon Hara has gotten very, very popular in the sense that people are conscious of it. We have the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation here in Baltimore. There have been a number of groups, although it always strikes me, why is it only women that are, women get together and talk about not speaking Lashon Hara? I guess we men are above all that, you know, we could use it too, obviously. But again, it's kedai to remember that one of the reasons why Lashon Hara is such a complicated halacha is that sometimes it's not just a question of not saying Lashon Hara. Sometimes you are actually obligated to say things. So, example, in the area of Shiduchim, it's very, very complicated. I know some derogatory information about the chassan or the kala. I can't just say I'll be machmir, I'll be strict, I'll take the stricter way. What's the stricter way? If you simply say I don't say it, you might be over on lo samad al dam reyecha, which says you're not allowed to stand by idly when somebody's going to get hurt. So sometimes you don't have the choice of deciding whether I'll talk or not. Sometimes it is forbidden to say anything. And sometimes you are obligated to say something, and if you don't say it, it's a very big aveira. One has to know. One has to learn these halachas. One has to have a posek, a rav that they discuss this with. These are issues that come up all the time. I remember when I was growing up, in the days when television was a little more benign than it is today, they used to have commercials for products. They would never show the competitor. Let's assume that you were trying to have a taste test and show that Coke is better than. So they would have the products covered up in a paper bag, and people would drink it. Brand X. I don't remember Brand X. And today, of course, they always show all the different competitors. And that's a whole area of Lashon Hara. Are you allowed, if you want somebody's business, and he tells you he's going to Shmerel instead of you, are you allowed to say, well, you know, Shmerel's business, Shmerel doesn't repair cars very well, etc. Are you allowed to disparage a competitor in order to get business, even if it's true? Is that called Lashon Hara? On the other hand, maybe it's a mitzvah if the guy's going to do a bad job. Very, very complicated halachas that you need to go over, because you're balancing two different halachic requirements. There is the requirement of not speaking Lashon Hara, but then there's the requirement of saving people from suffering detriment or harm. And that requires you to speak sometimes, right? So the Chafetz Chaim has different guidelines. So these three halachic areas certainly are always in the workplace all the time. Let's say you have, again, I can give you example after example. Let's say your job is to be a supervisor of a workforce. Let's say you supervise employees. That means every 3 months you got to fill out a report regarding how good they are. Are you allowed to do it? Are you allowed to say, well, they were late 5 days of the month? On one hand, you know, you're saying some negative information that could result in them either losing their job or being put on probation or getting less money. On the other hand, isn't the employer entitled to know that information? By the way, Lashon Hara even applies to our children. We cannot speak Lashon Hara about our children. We sometimes think, you know, we could just talk indiscriminately about the damage our little darling did that day. It's not true. If it's to a teacher or whatever it is, people who need to know, it's part of chinuch. But the stamazai treat your child like he's hefker, he or she is hefker, is obviously not the case, right? So these are some halachic issues to be aware of. Now, there are other issues too, which I think are less important today, particularly in a place like Baltimore. You know, if you went back 30 years ago, the issue was, can I eat, non-kosher, or can I eat in a non-kosher, can I have a Coke in a non-kosher restaurant, and the like. These are still halachic issues, but again, with the proliferation of kosher, places you could eat. And also, Shabbos is less of a problem today because, there are laws that protect you. So some of the old questions of Shabbos and kosher are not as important today as they used to be, but we still have the Gezel, the Lashon Hara, and the Arayos, which could be major, major issues. But as I said before, I think the major issue we face are not technical halachic issues. The major issues we face are the undermining of our values and our spiritual sensitivities, and the fact that exposure to much in the outside world, whether it be in the form of work, education, amusements, entertainments, all of these things tend to undermine our spiritual sensitivities for Yiddishkeit. Let me mention one particular aspect of this. The Gemara gives us a story of a rabbi whose name was Rabba Bar Barchana. This is a Gemara in Bava Metzia. And he once hired workers to transport some wine from place A to place B. And the workers were negligent, and they broke the wine. They broke the barrel, and they caused the wine to sink into the ground. He sued the workers for compensation because they damaged his property. And the workers' only defense was, we're poor and we really can't afford it. So the great Amora Rav Paskin, the workers don't have to pay. So Rabba Bar Barchana said to the Rav, why is that so? I mean, I know they can't pay me now, but just because they can't afford it? Is that the law? Is that the din? And Rav said to Rabba Bar Barchana, for you, that's the din. Yeah, for you, that's the law. Because you're supposed to try to be a righteous person. Well, then they turned around in an early example of chutzpah, and they said, wait a minute, you didn't pay us for our work today. So he was a little outraged. He says, it's not enough that you destroyed my wine that was many times worth your salary, and you don't have to pay me, and I have to pay you? And they said, yeah, we have to eat. We have families. And they went back to Rav, and Rav said, pay them for their work. And he asked Rav, is that the din? And Rav said, for you, that's the din. Orchos, quoting a pasuk in Mishlei, Orchos tzadikim tishmor. You should follow the way of the righteous. Now, what is that Gemara teaching us? That Gemara is teaching us, of course, the Gemara was not stating the halakha. The halakha is you don't have to pay a worker who's negligent in his work. You don't have to pay a worker who destroys your property. And in fact, the worker has to pay you. But what is Rav teaching us? Rav is teaching us that if a person aspires to be a righteous person and a good person, you have to learn to be mochel, you have to learn to forgive, you have to learn to forego, you have to learn not to assert your rights to the fullest. You might be 100% right and you're still 100% wrong. Learn to forgive. Learn not to go to the very end. Well, in professional and business life, one of the qualities we sometimes acquire is a certain amount of aggressiveness, of trying to get what we're entitled to get, no matter what. And even if, according to halacha, you may have the right to demand that, but that inculcates a certain negative midah of selfishness. Now, there was a book written, Looking Out for Number One, which kind of exemplifies the attitude in which you got to look at yourself as number one and look out for number one. Of course, Hillel also says, Inein ani li, mi li. If I'm not for myself, who will look out for me? Yes! But Hillel then adds, Uchsha ani li atzmi. If I'm only for myself, ma ani. What type of person am I? What is my life? What is a human being if he's only concerned for himself? And yet, one of the dangers we face in professional life is going for that final. You know, Alexandre de Tocqueville, who was a very, very well-known author, from France, who wrote a book about the United States in the early years of the American Republic, Democracy in America, it's actually a very famous book, described America back in the 1790s as a very litigious country. That if people had their fence 1/16th of an inch over my boundary, I took them to court. We fight. In fact, it's statistically true that America has many more lawyers per capita per 1,000 people than any other country in the world. We have 20 times more lawyers per 1,000 people than Japan, for example. In fact, if any of you or your husbands do business in Japan, tell them he should not bring a lawyer to negotiation. If he brings a lawyer to a contract negotiation, that is treated as very, very rude, and they'll break off right away. In America, you bring a lawyer to everything. Right, you buy a house, you have to have a lawyer at the closing. And the concept is, because in the United States, and again, I mean, American culture has some good features about it too, and I'll talk about that. But in American culture, the concept is we look at the world as owing us something. Es kommt mir. And if you're stepping on my toes, I will get you for that. And I will make you, you know, pay. And in a way, this is the opposite of a Torah hashgafa that never really asks the question, Magioli, what do I get from the world? But always asks, what are my responsibilities? It's been pointed out that halacha never, even the vocabulary of halacha is so interesting. Halacha, when it describes Reuven and Shimon, what are their rights? It never says Reuven has a right to be paid from Shimon. It never describes things in terms of rights. It always describes things in terms of obligations. Now, you might say, well, semantically, that's the same. If Reuven owes Shimon money, isn't that the same thing as saying Reuven is entitled to be paid? Well, it may be practically the same thing, but philosophically, it's a very different point. In America, when I get up in the morning, I ask myself, what does the world owe me today? When a Jew gets up in the morning, the Jew asks, what are my responsibilities to Hashem, to Klal Yisrael, to the world? What are my chiyuvim? Not what are my zechusim. In fact, the Sfas Emes says a very beautiful thought. He says, why are Jews called Yehudim? After all, Yehuda is only one particular tribe. The Sfas Emes says, Leah called her fourth son Yehuda, because she said, Hapam Odes Hashem, now I am grateful to God. Why was she grateful to God when she had Yehuda? So Rashi explains, she knew with Ruach HaKodesh that there would be 12 Shvatim, and she knows there are four wives, right? Bilha, Zilpah, Rachel, and Leah. So she figures the first three are coming to her, because 12 divided by 4 is 3. So she wasn't grateful because that was coming to her. But when she had the fourth, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki, I got more than I deserve, that's gratitude. So here's what the Sfasemis says. Every Jew is called a Yehudi because we must go through life with the attitude, Natalti Yeser Al Chelki, Hashem has given me more than I deserve. By the way, this is a midah that is so important for us to have, of course. And again, I have to say that although it is entirely possible for children to be greater than their parents, it's entirely possible, but you can't bet on it, unfortunately. Meaning to say, when I talk about what the midahs we need to impart in our children, I also mean the midahs that we need to work on ourselves. You know, one of the problems we have in such a materialistic culture is people are never satisfied. You know, you go to the amusement park Chol HaMoed and you leave after 6 hours. And so, we haven't had enough yet. I remember when I was zochet to spend a year in Eretz Yisrael 2 years ago. And I was living actually in neighborhoods that were economically depressed. People were not very well off. I remember seeing many times how, you know, there's a makolet, a little grocery store every few blocks. And how kids would buy an ice cream cone. And they would divide it among four siblings. And it was a real treat. It was a real joy, like a pleasure. They got a pleasure in simple, inexpensive things because they weren't habituated and addicted to more and more and more and more and more. And if we think sometimes we give our kids a service, do them a taiva, by giving them whatever they want, we don't realize that doesn't make them happier. Because ultimately, with Gashmias, you know, the more you give, the more you want. Chazal say, a person has 100, they want 200. And that's how it is. There's no real satisfaction. And the reason is very simple. The reason is because in reality, it is the neshama that needs things. And, you know, we try to placate the neshama with bribes and all sorts of things, but that doesn't really satisfy it. What is really at aching is a spiritual need. And therefore, the physical things are never going to satisfy it. Because that's not addressing the problem. It's like somebody has a heart attack and, you know, you're putting bandages on their arm. That's not doing anything. But if we teach our children and ourselves, and I go back, it always goes back to ourselves, to be genuinely happy with the simple things of life. The fact, you know, there's grass, there's flowers, there's air, there's health. What is a bracha? Rav Victor Miller died recently. He was Nifrinish, a very, very great man. I remember reading a book of his many years ago. I call it Meditation on a Banana. Maybe some of you have seen this. It's based on the Chavos HaLevavos, but he has a long 20-page essay on what you think about when you eat a banana. About the color, I can't possibly do it justice, but you know, about the color and the texture and the smell and the apple, the aroma and the chesed of Hashem in planning this out. And this is what a bracha is, to be thankful. I read a story in the Jewish Observer recently about him, that his granddaughter once came home and found him with his head submerged underwater in a sink. So she was a little taken aback, and she asked him, Zadie, why are you underwater? He said, you know, today I was walking with somebody in Brooklyn, and somebody said, you know, the air is really polluted today. The air just isn't good. And I felt bad because normally I'm so grateful for the air, and I was having a little tinnitus on the Ribono Shel Olam. You know, the air was lousy today. So I put my head underwater to see what it's like not to have air at all. And then when I lifted up my head after a few seconds, I said, air is good. You know, the air is very good. You know, and these are lessons in Hakaras HaTov. Now I understand that when you think of this topic, you know, you probably thought I would address, and I'll talk about a little bit about how to deal with apikorsis and how to deal with ideas. But I guess my overall thesis is that the biggest nisayon we face today is not primarily in the realm of heretical ideas. It is in the realm of emotion, passion, of the basic feelings of Hakaras HaTov, of a materialism that engulfs us and spoils us and spoils our children. So it's not so much, you know, even college, for example, you know, if you went to the 19th century and you asked Gedolim, you know, what are the nisyonos of college? So they would say, Apikorsis, people are going to read Hegel and Kant, and they'll stop believing in God. Well, I teach in law school. Halvai they would read Hegel and Kant. Most of them had never even heard of Hegel and Kant. Nobody becomes an Apikorsis today because they were exposed to such exciting intellectual ideas. I mean, that's a madrega, right? That's a madrega to become an Apikorsis because you read Hegel and Kant. Today, the issue is the decadence, the materialism, the laziness, the lack of Hakaras HaTov. These are not ideas in the head. These are problems of the heart and of the emotions. And they are much, much greater in Sakana than even the ideas of Apikorsis. Frankly, because as I say, today we're not a very intellectual society. Even at college campuses, people take the courses in college that'll prepare them for careers. There are very few people who are osek in chachmas chitzonios lishma, to be able to delve into chachmas yavanis and everything else. So I don't have a tremendous solution for this, other than to say that we have to strive to create these homes. And of course, that involves spending time with our children. That involves teaching them these lessons. That involves, I was aware of a person when he taught his, the father and the mother taught their child to say brachos. Instead of teaching the child to say it in Hebrew as a bracha, he wanted the child to say in English, because English was the first language, so he understood it better, Hashem, I want to thank you for this wonderful gift. And when he said that, and he internalized that message, then he says it in Hebrew too. Now we're going to say it in Hebrew. So it doesn't become just a ritual. It becomes something that you feel every time. Hakaras HaTov. These are the types of things that we talk about. The concept of giving to others. The concepts of sharing. Because again, we live in such a culture where people are so preoccupied with themselves. So these are really the greatest sakanas that we face. Let me tell you a beautiful mashal from Rav Shvadron, who said it in the name of his Rebbe, Rav Leib Chassman. When Yaakov is fighting with the angel of Esav, and it's towards the morning, and Yaakov asks the angel before the morning, tell me your name. So the angel says, Lama zeh tishal lishmi. Why do you ask me my name? So Rashi explains, the angel doesn't have a single name, meaning an angel has many missions. So when I have this mission, I have this name. When I have this mission, I have this name. I don't have a single name. So according to Rashi, the angel is basically telling Yaakov, you're asking me for my name? I don't have a single name. That's how Rashi understands it. Rav Shvadron quotes his Rebbe, who gives a different pshat. Yaakov asks the angel, what is your name? The angel's answer is, my name is, I don't have a name. That's my name. My name is, I don't have a name. What type of name is that? I don't have a name. So he gave the following mashal. There was a farmer in Europe, a Polish farmer, a peasant, who once came to the big city the first time in his life. And he was told, he was amazed with tractors and cars and everything else, and he was told if he buys a ticket and goes into that room, a movie theater, he will see people and animals coming out of the wall. Real people. And he couldn't believe this. It made no sense to him. He bought the ticket. He walked into a room that's totally dark. And he's wondering what's happening. All of a sudden, he sees animals and people. It was a cowboy western. He sees cowboys and Indians coming out of the wall. And he thinks it's real. And he can't believe it. There was a solid wall there a minute ago. How did they come out of the wall? So he pulls out his big new flashlight that he bought that day. And he shines it on the wall to get a better look. But of course, what happens is, when you shine a bright light on a movie screen, and you know, basically you don't see it anymore. So people were yelling at him, and they told him, sit down. We can only see the pictures when it's dark. What is the lesson? What is the mashal? How does it apply to Yaakov? So Shvadron used to say that when we live in darkness, when our hearts are not attuned to Hashem, when we don't feel the sweetness of Torah, we think we see all sorts of things that look beautiful and meaningful and real. But they're an illusion. They're like the two-dimensional pictures on a movie screen. When you turn on the light, then you see all of those things that you thought were important were garnished. And all of the things you didn't even notice when you turned on the light, you begin to see. That's what the angel is saying. When Yaakov asks the angel, tell me your name. You know, the angel is the Saro Shel Esav, the Yetzer Hara, the Koach of Tuma. And when Yaakov asks him, what is your name? He's asking, what is your power over people? How do you get people enslaved under your regimen? And his answer was, my power is nobody bothers to truly understand me. No one asks my name. Meaning my power is people don't think. They go on automatic pilots. They just go through life with inertia. And when the lights are off, you see all sorts of beautiful things which aren't really there. But when you turn on the lights, you know that it's just an illusion. What a person needs to do, obviously, therefore, is if you cannot be surrounded with Kiddush Hashem the whole day, you have to try to create your own. Number one, keep in mind, and again, people here are all different. Some people are full-time parent. Well, everyone is a full-time parent that has a child, obviously. But some people are home most of the day. Some people might be outside of the home. But whatever it is, the person has to consciously think, what I am doing with my life is to serve Hashem. If I'm with my children, it obviously is serving Hashem to create Avdei Hashem, lovers of God, people who have Yiras Hashem, people who love other Jews, people who are kind and compassionate and considerate. And again, I will repeat because I love to repeat this many, many times. And to see the Tzelem Elokim in all human beings, obviously that's a conscious avoda. If I'm working in an office, then my avoda is that I'm going to sanctify HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the way I conduct my business, the way I talk to secretaries, receptionists, employers, employees, co-workers, people off the streets. And if before you do a mitzvah you say hinani muchan umazuman, then before you go to work in the morning or before you interact with your children in the morning, you could say hinani muchan umazuman. I am now going to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this noble, noble task. So the point is, anything a person does, the Rambam writes on the pasuk in Mishlei, b'chol derachecha do'eyu, you can know Hashem in all of your ways. The Rambam writes that if a person eats or sleeps with the intention that they are doing so to serve Hashem, then the eating and the sleeping and the dreaming and even the vacationing is all a Kiddush Hashem. It is Avodas HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You know, the Chafetz Chaim used to say, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu, we're going to read it in 2 weeks, by the burning bush, by the sneh, he told Moshe Rabbeinu, take off your shoes, because the place where you are standing is holy ground. Admas Kodesh. The Chafetz Chaim says that is a message to every single Jew, every single moment of our lives. Sometimes we think Kedusha is only in a certain place, in a certain time. Sometimes we think, if only I had a different teacher or a different place or a different house or a different family, perhaps then I could serve Hashem properly. But Nebuch, where I am, I just don't have the potential. I don't have the kalim. The answer is no. The place where you are, the place where you're standing, the place where Hashem put you, that is the Atmas Kodesh. That is the holy ground by which you can make the name of Hashem beloved. You can create Kiddush Hashem. And you can create Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, in whatever environment that you are in. So as I say, this may be disappointing, and maybe we'll have some time for questions. I understand that I have not dealt that much with the apikorsis aspect of it. Because to me, the nisayon of decadence, laziness, ingratitude, secularism is much more pernicious than the ideas that might be out there one way or the other. I'm not sure what our time is. Someone will tell me when. You'll tell me when time is up. Okay, very good. Yeah. So I just want to end with a vort from Rav Tzadok of Lublin. Rav Tzadok of Lublin comments by the Aseres Hadibros. The Torah describes Maimon Har Sinai, and it talks about Kolos Uvrakim. There was thunder and there was lightning, and people were very afraid. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Aseres Hadibros, and right afterwards, it repeats the scene, but instead of saying Kolos Uvrakim, it says Kolos V'Lapidim. What is a lapid? A torch. So, what is the nafkamina? What is the difference between bursts of lightning and a torch in the sky? Like, why was there a difference? So Rav Tzadok says, the difference in their visualization represents a metamorphosis in the idea of holiness before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah. Before Matan Torah, Kedusha was described as a burst of lightning. After Matan Torah, it was described as a torch. How is that so? Even before the Torah was given, human beings wanted to become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But the question is, how can my soul become close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu if I have so many physical needs, eating and drinking and sleeping and everything else? There was a dichotomy between body and soul, which meant that the only way you could become holy and approach Hashem was by separating yourself from the physical world. That type, right? That's why, for example, in much of Christianity, the holy person doesn't marry, right? Celibacy, a very controversial decision. The holy person renounces possessions, although the monastery is allowed to have a VCR and everything else, but the individual priest cannot own anything. You have to renounce because this world, so they say, is evil. It will drag you down, and the more you're involved, the less you're connected to Hashem. And therefore, your holiness is disengagement. And therefore, Rav Tzadok says, that is lightning. Because what is lightning? A beautiful, brilliant flash of light. But then it's punctuated by total darkness. Because if your holiness depends on separating from this world, by definition, it's going to be temporary, it's going to be ephemeral, it's going to be transient, because eventually you have to eat, eventually you have to sleep, eventually you have to come down from the mountain. Matan Torah created a new idea in how a Jew becomes holy. A Yid becomes holy not by rejecting this world. A Yid becomes holy by embracing this world. We can eat, we can drink, we are not only are allowed to have families, it's a mitzvah to get married and have families. Because we believe that with the right kavana, with the right intention, one can elevate the most physical acts and turn them into acts of godliness, acts of kedusha. Now that's, in a way, it's very, very difficult. Because when your kedusha is separated, you have to think about it this way, lightning is brighter than a torch. When your holiness means I put this world aside and I go off into my corner and I meditate, I have ecstasy, I have excitement, I have passion, everything's wonderful. When I got to get involved in carpool and cleaning and setting up for Shabbos, I don't always feel those great highs. But Rav Tzadok says, a torch is much more permanent than lightning. Lightning is brilliant light followed by total darkness. The torch gives you warmth. If you had to navigate, imagine if you're leaving Tzfat, and you have to navigate those mountain roads, very, very dangerous roads. The buses, you know, even the Eged buses slow down to around 75 miles an hour. You know, they know they can't go at regular speed, right? The point is, I would not want to navigate those mountain turns by lightning, because I get like a split second of lightning, then I'm in dark. With a torch, I might be able to make it. Life is a tortuous path. We're often confronted with ambiguities. We're confronted with confusion. And Rav Tzadok says this is even kind of a tragic way. In other words, in a way, if we would be like Malachi Asharis, life would be easier. We would have our mission, we would have our task, we wouldn't have to deal with all of these ambiguities. But Hashem gave us this message that the Torah is not like a flash of lightning that then turns totally dark. The Torah is that flickering torch that gives you light and that gives you guidance, but it does require that you navigate the tortuous mountain pathways of life. I should say, too, that women actually have, according to the Maharal, have a unique capacity to sanctify and consecrate this physical world more than men. I'm sure those of you who are married have probably heard at your own Sheva Brachos the famous vort that Ish and Isha have the same two letters of Aleph and Shin. It's Gemara, which is fire. And Yud and He are the letters of God's name. So when Hashem is in their marriage, we have Ish and Isha. If you take Hashem out of the marriage, the Yud and the He out, there is Eish, all-consuming, selfish fire. Right, that's a beautiful Gemara. But the Maharal takes the Gemara one step further, and that is, why does the man get the letter Yud of God's name, and the woman get the letter He? Like, why of those two letters? So he says the following. The Gemara tells us in Menachos that Yud is the spiritual force by which God created Olam Haba. Hey is the spiritual force by which God created Olam Hazeh. Why is this so? So the Maharal says, Yud has no spatial dimensions. A Yud is a point, technically. So that represents pure Ruchnius, which does not have any time or space limitations. Hey is a composite letter. Imagine a Hey. It's a Dalet. And the number four represents pure Gashmias, because we talk about four dimensions of matter: length, width, breadth, and time is a dimension of matter. So it wasn't only Einstein that said this. I mean, the Maharal identified it as well. And we talk about the four directions: north, south, east, west. So Dalet is pure physicality. And the Maharal looks at a He as a combination of Dalet and Yud. I would have thought Dalet and Vav, but his thought is Dalet and Yud. So what is He? He is bringing the Yud, which is pure Ruchnius, into the Dalet, which is pure Gashmius. Meaning, and again, these are generalizations, of course, man's nature, because of the idea of conquest, domination, is to often be corrupted by exposure to that environment. The environment of the outside world brings out the worst in a man. And thus, just as a person who has emphysema might have to be put on pure oxygen, the man might often need pure ruchnius, as it were, to get away from the gashmius. That's why we have kolalim, that's why we have yeshivos, that's why we even have minyan, possibly. The man have to get away from it. The woman's avoda, in many ways, is much more difficult. The woman doesn't get away from it. The woman is it, is with it. And that is the madrega of the hay, in which the Yud goes into the Dalet and transforms it. Now, in a sense, the gematria of Yud is 10, the gematria of He is 5. In a sense, what that means is that in many cases, the spirituality might be less intense at any moment in time, because certainly it's more intense to be in a totally ruchniistic environment. But, as Rav Tzadok says, the ultimately highest madrega of Kedusha is to be able to be machnes kedusha, even into the gashmias. And this, of course, is the achrayas of mothers above all, because you are the ones that are creating the spiritual environment for the child. Again, it's a joint effort, but certainly in the early years, the mother role tends to be more predominant. And if the father will be the one that may supply later a lot of the cognitive information about being a Jew, those primal feelings of reverence for God and love of God, hakara satov, appreciation of the world, looking at people in a good way, those are midos. Again, we believe you can get them any age, because there's always tshuva. I don't mean to say if you don't have them, you'll never have them. I don't mean that. But just to be realistic, these things are harder to get as you get older. And if you have the opportunity to be mashrish these midos at a young age, that's a great, great, rare opportunity that one should treasure and one should cherish and one should take a great, great advantage of. So I guess I have a few minutes for questions if people want, or comments or disagreements or whatever. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Well, as I say, the defenses, one reason why it's so hard is that, you know, we don't live in moats, meaning we send our kids to school, and even if you send your kids to a Jewish school and a frum school, there may be other kids, other parents who may not have that same commitment in that same way. I know, just to take a relatively trivial example, but an example that has some relation to this, some parents don't want their kids to eat candy. Right? Okay? As soon as a kid starts school, that becomes almost impossible, simply because, you know, he'll trade the vegetables for the candy with somebody else, or whatever it is. There might be some odd candy kid from a candy family who may like vegetables for some reason, you know, but, you know, it may work. The answer is this. You have to understand that we cannot, unfortunately, immunize our children from all influences. It's an illusion. It's not going to happen. You have to have the wisdom of knowing when to choose your fights. Because if every single thing a child does is going to be criticized and corrected, he or she is going to turn it off and stop listening. So you have to be very careful. You have to determine what's an eker and what's a tuffel. I'll give you a practical example. If a child comes home and says hurtful things about other people, you can't compromise on that. That has to be corrected. If a child lies, that has to be corrected. If a child gave away his vegetables, you know, you could indicate that, you know, this is not your preference, but that's not necessarily an issue. If a child, let's say a little older, doesn't wear a black hat for mincha, when that's the minhag of the family, you got to watch it because it may lead to other things. But, you know, you don't necessarily have to make an issue about certain externalities, even though it may embarrass you. Sometimes we're upset about things our kids do, not because they're intrinsically so bad, but because other people see them and it reflects poorly on us. You have to be careful, because essentially that shouldn't be the fact. Although it's totally human, but that shouldn't be the factor. So there's a very big chachma in knowing when to take a position and when not. I think that there's a psychologist in Toronto who writes very useful books, Sarah Hannah Radcliffe. Maybe you've seen it. She wrote Azer Kenegdo. She wrote some books on child raising as well. But she writes that optimally, the ratio of interactions, positive and negative, to our children should be 75-25. We should strive that 75% of our communications are positive. She suggests that if we were to carry around a tape recorder, we might have an opposite ratio. Because after all, when things are good, we tend not to say anything. You know, we only intervene when things are negative. I think that if you follow Chazal's Eitzah, that the right hand, which is the dominant strong hand, draws near, and the discipline is with the left hand. You have discipline, but it's the weaker part of the relationship. I think you have a very, very good chance of your children just seeing. And of course, what do they say? There's an old saying, children may not listen to us, but they always imitate us, which is very, very interesting. And that is, if you create the type of home in your own life, even something simple, Rebbetzin Freifeld used to say, she recommended women to sing while they're going around the house, or to play music when they're going around the house. A little thing like that. It just creates an atmosphere that the house is serving Hashem, doing mitzvos, is a joyous thing. And that does rub off on children. Even if they're adolescents and they're sullen and they're cynical and they don't, you know, admit it to you, which is often the case, but you'd be surprised what they really feel, even if they don't, talk about it. Different kids may need different things. I think all in all, you have to follow Chazal's directive. There needs to be discipline, but the discipline should be relatively gentle. It should be selective but consistent, meaning by selective I mean you make a list and discuss it about what you consider to be absolutely fundamental. And with respect to and that should be relatively few things, by the way. And on that list, you are consistent and thorough and unyielding. On other things, you have preferences, etc. But you don't necessarily make a federal case out of it. And you have to decide, together with your husband or whatever, what is truly important. What is our hashgafa here? What is not? And differentiate between the essence of Yiddishkeit and what you might call the sociological trappings. There are sociological aspects of being a Jew, which have their importance, but they're not necessarily going to be that important. Now, again, I know this is not giving you a specific answer, and it's hard for me to give you a specific answer, but you just have to know that there is a problem of tafasta meruba lo tafasta, which means you try to grab on too much, you get nothing at all. Remember the famous Aesop's fable about the hand in the cookie jar? Right. The person tried to grab all the cookies and he couldn't pull his hand out. And, you know, you have to be very, very cognizant of that. But as I say, as soon as your child enters a playgroup, you have lost that control. As soon as the child's born, you've lost the control. But you've lost the illusion of control as soon as that child joins a playgroup. Was there another question or comment? Okay, well, thank you very much. And Shavlada Fatzlacha, and we should all be so good. Oh, you look familiar. Just tell me that. Oh, yes. Hi, how are you? You look a little different. Okay. How are you? Good to see you.